This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
To begin with, a classroom and a hat. The opening of Alain Fournier's novel Le Grand Monde reminds me of that of Flaubert's Madame Bovary. In that book, a boy comes into a country schoolroom carrying an astonishing contraption, part peaked cap, part nightcap, part bearskin, part bowler. This glorious mishmash of a piece of headgear isn't just a nice detail. It foreshadows other grotesque muddles and mismatches that will follow, as Flaubert's savage comedy gathers pace. In Fournier's novel, published just under half a century later, in 1913, the new boy who enters the country classroom is Augustin Mone, the Grand Mone of the title, and his hat is the typical felt one worn by the peasants of the time. The second hat in Fournier's opening pages is that modelled by the narrator's mother on the very Sunday evening when Mone first arrives, an improvised arrangement of ribbons, feathers and gold threads. If hats may represent ways of thinking, then Fournier's novel swivels between the serviceable workaday felt hat and the elaborate confection worn on days of rest when the spirit may take flight. Hats off, and for a while the two novels remain superficially alike. Both share an intense awareness of rural scenes, the apparently unchanging customs and protocols of agricultural life. Milk must be fetched, horses shod, children bustled off to school, torn smocks mended. Both novels deal with their central protagonist's longing for erotic adventure, which means leaving home and disobeying rules. Emma Bovary, the young married woman stuck in a muddy Norman landscape, escapes to the forest, to seduction in a green glade, and to masquerades in the dance halls of Rouen. Augustin Mone, Fournier's adolescent hero, runs away from boarding school in the icy terrain of the Sologne in central France and discovers a magical chateau, a new best friend, a beautiful blonde châtelaine. However, Flaubert's work, which began appearing in parts in 1856, seems much more modern than Fournier's, published so much later. This is not just because of the originality and freshness of his famous free indirect style. It's also to do with a narrative's attitude to its subject matter. Flaubert's alerts us to questions of social change, the influence of mass-produced artefacts on people's desires, the sexual hungers hiding under fantasies of romance. His novel drives towards a future, even if this turns out to be a tragic one. Fournier's novel, apparently concerned with the journey towards love and fulfilment, sounds an elegiac and wistful note, seems preoccupied with the past. Why has Fournier's Le Grand Monde been so admired? Educationalists have certainly endorsed it. Until fairly recently, Le Grand Monde was required reading for adolescents on both sides of the Channel, a haloed set text, solidly part of the baccalaureat and French A-level syllabus for generations. Yet even more than this canonical status, the novel has acquired mythic and archetypal value, revered as the novel that reveals the secrets and truths of young people's souls. This may have something to do with the way that Le Grand Monde gets read retrospectively through the lens of poignancy. It came out in 1913 and was an instant hit. The Great War broke out the following year. Wave after wave of young men were dispatched to their deaths. Fournier, aged 28, was killed in action in the earliest weeks of the war. Perhaps we read his novel in the context of our sorrow for that terrible waste of life. The novel gets retrospectively ransacked for details of autobiography, as though the dead writer can be magically preserved alive in his tale, taken up into a heaven of literary immortality. Fournier's anecdotes of his life become part of the myth of his novel. For example, much has been made of his account of once spotting a pretty young woman in a Parisian street, following her home, discovering her engagement to someone else, being asked not to approach her again. This seems exactly to match events described in Le Grand Monde. Hindsight operates sentimentally. Oh, poor young man, He was deprived not only of his life, but also of his one true love. However, a novel does not and cannot simply make a copy of its author's life. It's an artifice constructed in language. So to find other clues to the novel's appeal, let's return to the text itself. A writer finds and wrestles with language. How that wrestling's done, why it's embarked upon at all, may depend on what goes on inside the writer, which may feel, to the writer, underneath or beyond language. Looking closely at the language of Le Grand Monde, I see certain images and words recurring, which suggest a powerful and dominant theme. One such word is dream. The novel's narrator is François Sorel, Mone's school friend. He recounts the story that Mone recounts to him of his life-changing escapade in the recent past. Mone has stolen a horse and cart for a joke and driven off alone into the wintry countryside. His account of his big adventure begins with him falling asleep in the cart, dazed by cold. When he comes to, the scenery has changed. His falling asleep signifies that Mone has entered a different realm. He wakes not out of dreams, but into them. In Western literature, from the Old Testament onwards, dreams form the gateway to altered states of being, new ways of seeing, which let us escape the daytime bonds of space and time, also, indeed, of storytelling. Le Grand Monde begins as poetically rendered naturalism, grounded in the everyday worlds of the blacksmiths, the café, the village shop, the charmingly precise details of herrings grilling on the schoolroom stove, boys in clogs pounding along snowy lanes. It then becomes something else, a crazy paving plot of wild coincidences, impossible explanations, lengthy and apparently pointless digressions mixed up with hugely condensed and compressed mini-scenes, vignettes of characters in ridiculous disguises, resonant visual images, stories within stories. Structurally, the novel becomes, in fact, like a dream. Mone, at first lost in a landscape of endlessly criss-crossing lanes with no signposts, like the free associations of a poet's mind, then has to negotiate the endless and confusing corridors and courtyards of the magical manor house, La Domaine, when finally he tumbles upon it. Just as dreams allow for carnivalesque reversals and topsy-turviness, and flourish on them, so does the world of the Domaine. The ancient manor house is full of children and adolescents, run by them, children in charge, wielding all the power. Adults exist just to indulge the children's every whim and to ensure the enchanted party goes with a swing, that the lanterns are lit, the fancy dress costumes and food and music provided, the scene set. The daughter of the Domaine, Yvonne de Galais, with whom Mone falls in love at first sight, embodies a certain conventional ideal of fairy tale heroine. Delicately beautiful, golden-haired, passive, modest, shy. Her brother France, whose engagement all the guests have been summoned to celebrate, is handsome, romantic, melancholy. An idealised version of Mone, and perhaps of François too. The impossibly exquisite house party forms the jewel-like, glittering centre of the novel. Fournier encircles it, seals it off, by repeatedly referring to the dreamlike quality of events as they unfold. He continues to build up the fairy tale elements of his story, to refer explicitly to the tropes of romance. Mone gazes at his reflection in the frozen surface of a pond in the icy garden. No longer the schoolboy who had escaped in a peasant's cart, but a charming, romantic figure out of the pages of an expensive album. Magically, spring seems suddenly to have arrived, the frost melting, the wet grass gleaming, and the birds singing. Yvonne is the princess, the fairy queen. The dream shatters when France's promised bride, Valentine, does not appear. Yvonne vanishes at the same time. Mon is pushed out of the magic castle and forced to return to the schoolhouse where François awaits him. Recounting his tale of enchantment, he embroils François in his obsession with finding again the Domaine, the lovely young woman. The shimmering beauty of Mon's dreams may come from the golden glow spread by the imagining of joyful sex and orgasm, but real sex with a real woman does not form part of the story. Even when Mon finally achieves what he assumes is his heart's desire and marries Yvonne, he abandons her the very next morning. Now the plot topples apart like a sandcastle kicked over by cross children. 9 months after her wedding night, Yvonne gives birth to a daughter, then dies. Valentine, the lost fiancée, turns out to be a humble seamstress. Blamed by Mon for all his and France's troubles, driven hither and thither by the male character's conflicts and desires, required by her prospective husband to give up work, she fears that poverty will force her onto the street to work as a prostitute, but is rescued by the narrator, François, and placed in a handy cottage. Rich and virtuous and passive, or poor and virtuous and passive, those are the roles for women in this novel. One traditional way of reading is to wish to identify with the novel's protagonists. The modern female reader, if she is not to howl with derision and toss the book across the room, will find that the only adventure the novel allows her is to change sex, or put on drag, and race off with Mon, France and François, away from women. That's what we can do in dreams. That's what we can do in fairy tales. Identify with both hero and heroine. Fournier's great achievement in Le Grand Monde is to put at its heart a powerful dream, a powerful conflict. The vision of the Domaine both conceals and displays the hero's ambivalence about growing up, maps the wish to go forwards towards real love, sex and marriage, onto the desire to stay forever in a perfect imaginary past. Mon deals with the crisis of adolescence through dreaming of paradise lost, fused with paradise regained. He will never have to risk being disappointed or let down by a woman. The future has already happened, and his dreams keep it safe. Fournier was writing out of a fin de siècle tradition that both idealised and demonised women. Lovely goddesses of hearth and home, or nightmare monsters intent on emasculating their men. Women were beginning to gain more social power and to wrestle with new conflicts around feminine identity. Could a woman dream of living life on her own terms? For Fournier's contemporary, the novelist Colette, the dream of Paradise Lost is imaged through references back to a Burgundian childhood presided over by her country goddess mother, Sido. Colette's characters know that paradise must be lost. The beloved mother must be left. Her power must be challenged. Only then can paradise be regained, as paradise reinvented, a very earthly, earthy paradise. I began this essay with images of country schoolrooms. Colette's debut, Claudine at School, similarly recreates such a place, but gives us, instead of Fournier's and Flaubert's death-doomed heroines, an adolescent protagonist who is explicitly greedy for life, adventures and sex, and who joyfully and ruthlessly survives. In 1913, exactly the year that Le Grand Monde came out, Colette published The Shackle, a sequel to her best-selling The Vagabond. In the latter novel, her narrator, René, oscillates between her desire to stay with her lover and her desire to go back on the road as a music hall artist on tour. The novel ends with her choosing freedom, travelling by train along the Provençal coastline. In The Shackle, René discovers that freedom and independence can involve loneliness and insecurity. She polishes her weapons. Good company, sardonic wit, unrelenting honesty. Preferring Colette's vision of youth to Fournier's, I yet respect his integrity, his commitment to creating a story about male romanticism, the shadow side of pornography, I suddenly realise. I also began this essay with images of hats. So, chapeau, maître.